Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. We hope you love the show and you love it so much that you'll want more info. Well, you can always find more info on everything you hear at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, more information on all of our guests and their books, and you can subscribe to our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about delicious things to make on weeknights. But right now, let's get to this week's show, hosted by Lynn Rosetto Casper.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. A woman who could be your grandmother has just slipped cans of cat food into her shopping cart. Now she can afford this month's medicines. This isn't a myth. 9.6 million seniors don't get enough to eat. This is where Robert Egger comes in. In 1989, Robert started DC Central Kitchen by training the people employers often ignored, ex-convicts and kids who had aged out of the foster care system. They sourced from local farmers, and DC Kitchen ended up doing 30 million meals, many of them supplying DC schools. Well, now Robert Egger is in Los Angeles. He's setting out to feed our most ignored citizens, seniors. Robert, good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Lynn.
So, from where you stand, what don't we understand about growing old in the United States?
Well, you know, there's the theory that we plan for old age based on wishful thinking, that somehow we'll all be healthy, we'll be happy, we'll have enough money put aside. And that's probably my greatest concern. It's just that you're going to see a significant amount of people who won't have enough money left for the extra year science is going to give them. And the question becomes, how do we take care of those men and women who pay taxes, contribute to our society, and are our elders?
So what does LA Kitchen do? Because I gather that one of your goals is to take care of those people.
It is. What I've launched in Los Angeles is more of a social business. We've arrived here and saying, you know, metaphorically to the city, you spend a significant amount of money on senior meal contracts, but you historically get processed meals made by people at a modest wage, and then profit leaves Los Angeles and never comes back. Let's try it a new way. You know, I'd like to apply for those contracts, and I'll make an effort to buy food from local farmers, which could include urban farms. I'll train and then employ men and women home from prison and give them good wage jobs. We'll prepare freshly scratched meals every single day, and money will never leave Los Angeles. It'll be reinvested either in wages, the support of to local farms, or back to support the job training program, which starts the process all over again.
Okay, but now money is the hitch here. I mean, how much is allotted by the government for a senior meal?
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, federal reimbursement drives so much of food policy and food in America, whether it's school food, prison food, senior meals. But senior meals currently have one of the highest reimbursement rates of about $3.50 to $3.80. Now, of course, that includes the meal itself and the labor and certain things like milk and condiments that go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's as you can imagine, there's a pretty historic system of Meals on Wheels and senior service centers. But I think what we're looking at is the baby boomers coming. And so not only will you have more people, but you're going to have, I think, a greater sense of expectation about nutritional content. And I think a much more of a great need and desire to be engaged beyond just, you know, playing dominoes and listening to Rudy Valley records.
You said at one point that there's a lot of rigidity around senior meals. And what do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, any system, when you come along and say, hey, let's try something new, you have to anticipate a certain amount of, and frankly, sometimes a lot of resistance to change.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have to, you know, you have to fight the system. So at one level, you're looking at a generation of nutritionists who were oftentimes trained 20, 30 years ago. as well as administrators that, for all intents and purposes, their machine's just chugging along. And here we're coming along saying, hey, let's look at the whole thing from soup to nuts. You know, what seniors are fed, where they're fed, what they do before, during, and after. You know, I'm just suggesting, and I think it's pretty clear, that the baby boomers are not going to be your grandfather's senior. They're going to want a whole different construct around aging. And I think what we're trying to do here and many other places is just get out in front and start the experiments now.
So what is that construct going to be?
Well, A, I think you're going to see a generation of much more nutritionally sophisticated seniors who are actually going to rebel against, you know, a processed meal, for lack of a better phrase. They're going to have their own kind of culture of food, which is, I think, very much part of the American landscape now. But I think you'll see many more doctors actually talking much more openly and up to the point of prescribing better fruits and vegetables, more local foods, healthier meals. So from every corner, I think the pressure is going to be on the system to deliver a better product. I think the question is, how do you do it for a reasonable amount of money? That's the experiment we're deeply into. How do you feed more people a healthier meal for less money?
All right. So the obvious question, how do you feed more people for not a great deal of money?
Well, you know, one of the breakthroughs we had in Washington, D.C. with the D.C. Central Kitchen, which I ran for many, many years and is now led by a great colleague, Mike Curtin, was going out to buy food from farmers. Instead of the charitable model of waiting for farmers to donate it, we started going out saying, hey, can we talk about buying the stuff that you might not have a good market for because it's overripe, underripe, bent, broken, bruised? And what we found is that we could access, you know, literally tons of locally sourced food that all it took was a little flip of a knife to remove that bruise or blemish. So that opened a huge door to a level of affordability for school food that we want to just transplant out here in Los Angeles, where you have, you know, just an insane growing season. So we can access incredibly beautiful, healthy food year-round.
So you're more or less – are you still in a startup situation at this point?
Well, we are. I mean, in fact, we partnered with a great senior meal program here, St. Vincent Meals on Wheels, that opened their kitchen to us to come in and begin our job training program. But our physical kitchen opened about 9 months ago. But sadly, I always say I love my job. I hate my business. Because what we're looking at is thousands of Angelenos, and sadly tens of thousands most likely, who are going to need some kind of nutritional support. So we're prepared to do between 10 and 15,000 a day when we really get up and going.
That's really impressive. What would be a typical meal?
Well, just yesterday we served salmon with buckwheat soba noodles and kind of a soba noodle coleslaw mix and then glazed carrots. So, and again, what's nice is we're able to include a lot of the California products. So, again, what we're after constantly is how can we source local, prepare freshly scratched meals, employ people, but like I said, get a meal in front of a senior that, you know, is really healthy, but it really looks like somebody made it. You know what I mean? I want people to really look down and say, wow, you know, that's like restaurant quality food. That's a beautiful dish. I want people to feel the love in it.
Thank you for talking with us, Robert.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Lynn. Thank you.
Robert Ager is founder and president of LA Kitchen. Now, head to the website, splendidtable.org, for more information. And if you want to hear more about food policy and hunger issues, subscribe to our podcast. We've spent years looking at the issues surrounding food and the environment and hunger. And you can hear interviews with big thinkers like Michael Pollan, Alice Waters, Marion Nestle, Will Allen, and lots more. Subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Each one of us eats nearly 25 pounds of candy a year. Yes, 25 pounds of candy a year. Now imagine that is a heap of 2,336 and a half Hershey's Kisses. So how did we get so hooked on sweets? A new book tells all. It is Sweet as Sin, the unwrapped story of how candy became America's favorite pleasure. And it comes to us care of a self-described candy historian, Susan Benjamin. Benjamin owns True Treats Candy, the only research-based historic candy company in the country. She sells authentic sweets from bygone days at her retail shops in Frederick, Maryland and Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. Our contributor, Rebecca Shear, brought her sweet tooth to the Harper's Ferry store and brings us this story.
At True Treats Candy, Susan Benjamin's motto is, "History never tasted so sweet." And in this country, candy history goes back to the early Native Americans.
So we have, for example, corn cob jelly. The Native Americans, way back, pre-settlers, used a corn cob as a sweet and so forth. They invented, as it were, corn syrup.
Susan's shop is arranged in chronological order up through the mid-20th century. When you first walk in, you'll see traditional Native American sweets like boiled hickory bark.
And it's a delicious maple-y kind of flavor.
Spruce tree resin.
Which the Native Americans of the area now, Maine, would have chewed.
Even packets of crickets and mealyworms, which Susan has labeled simply bag of bugs.
Well, bag o' bugs, yes.
Bag o' bugs.
Yeah.
Those would be bugs. Wow.
These are bugs, and they're just plain roasted bugs. They taste like sesame. People come in and go, what do they taste like, chicken? I go, yeah, chicken, sure.
Savoring insects was par for the course for early Native Americans, Susan Benjamin says. But as she leads me to another corner of the shop.
Come with me this way. We're heading to the 1950s.
She explains that eventually, edible critters turned into a kind of I dare you novelty.
In the 1950s, all the rage was chocolate-covered ants and other products with bees, crickets, and all these different insects. So, does you want to try one? It's chocolate with ants.
I feel like I would not be the fearless radio reporter if I said
okay.
No.
What do you think?
I'm just tasting the chocolate.
You are? Okay.
Oh, wait, there was a crunch.
Yep, it was a crunch. Okay.
That was the ant?
Yeah.
But roasted bugs, chocolate-covered ants, they're but a taste of candy's overall story. Susan's new book, Sweet as Sin, is bursting with tantalizing tales, as is her shop, where you can read each treat's backstory on its label.
When people come in, they always look at each other like, yeah, I've been to Cracker Barrel, right? But the difference between us and Cracker Barrel, we fundamentally do the research. What we're really talking about and what we're really selling, kind of, if you could put it that way, is the history and the stories.
Like, say, the story of the controversial confection created for traveling circuses in the 1800s, the Love It or Loathe It circus peanut. Susan, for the record, is on the Love It side. I'm more on the Loathe It.
You know, they defy the imagination because they're peanut shaped, they taste like a banana, and they're a color that doesn't exist in nature. But in 1963, the, I would argue, venerable circus peanut was the prototype for the Lucky Charm cereal.
I love the marshmallows and Lucky Charms.
Well, then you've got to love the circus peanut by relationship. If nothing else.
Susan and I also agree to ever so sweetly disagree on another famous candy, one invented by 19th century English immigrant Oliver Chase. He created it at his apothecary to soothe the throat and settle the stomach. But once Chase's enterprise became part of the New England Confectionery Company, or Necco, the lozenge became known as, you guessed it, the Necco wafer.
Some people, such as me, I love them. I grew up in Massachusetts, and they're a real part of my history, and some people think they're chalky.
The Necco wafer, as it happens, helped usher in a new era for candy. Oliver Chase had devised a machine that sliced and diced perfectly uniform discs of sugar. Up until then, sweets were made by hand. And Susan sells many of these rustic, irregular-looking candies in her shop, too. From lumpy, gooey molasses pulls.
That's very chewy.
Chewy?
Yeah. Like choppy.
Just made, yeah.
To thick, crunchy peppermint sticks.
That's delicious.
Yeah.
I like that it's kind of messed up looking.
I do too. And in the day, it's just how it was.
Now, you will find a number of mass-produced favorites at True Treats, like Turkish taffy, candy buttons, marshmallow peeps, and those venerable circus peanuts. But Susan gets much of her merchandise from smaller manufacturers, too, like the jugs of sorghum syrup cooked by a Mennonite farmer in Tennessee.
Oh, it's got like a deep...
nutty almost.
Sweet, nutty, yeah.
Yeah.
I would put this on pancakes any day. And the lemon and peppermint Gibraltars, made by the oldest commercial candy business in America, Ye Olde Pepper Company. Incidentally, Ye Olde Pepper Company began with an English immigrant named Mary Spencer, who sold homemade candy from a horse and buggy.
Mrs. Spencer, going from town to town, had a false bottom on her buggy. And you know why? Part of the Underground Railroad. And she had escaped slaves there, helping to bring them to their freedom. That's a good history, right? I love that story.
Susan loves her candy stories almost as much as she loves the candies themselves. And she hopes her readers will too. But she also hopes even the most ardent of candy fans will be surprised.
They're so excited in the store, and I wanted to put that in the book where they go, oh my gosh, and know this whole connection to this history.
Now, mind you, that history isn't always bright as a day glow nickel nip. For instance, Susan writes at length about sugar in America and its early ties to the slave trade. But she says in order to understand candy's past, people have to take in the bitter with the sweet.
I just want them to know things that we may not know about our history, about, say, the Native Americans or the enslaved people, that we'd never get to hear.
And at her shop, she hopes people will taste things they never get to taste, be it hand-pulled peppermint sticks or, yes, chocolate-covered ants.
Susan Benjamin is author of Sweet as Sim, the unwrapped story of how candy became America's favorite pleasure. Rebecca Shear is a journalist based in Washington, D.C. Now, for more information, head to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to take a look at this week's video. Host Francis Lamb demonstrates his skill technique for making garlic paste. It's everything you ever need to know about garlic, along with a recipe to put your new skills to work. Warm white beans with garlic and rosemary. Find it, you know where, splendidtable.org. Coming up, our monthly cooking science lesson with Molly Birnbaum of America's Test Kitchen. What makes cheese melt? Well, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. A slice of pizza trailing a long strand of melty cheese, a grilled cheese sandwich oozing at the edges. That sight is irresistible. And it's all about the melt factor. Do you know what makes cheese melt or not? It's the milk, which is what we're looking at today. Every month, we turn to executive editor Molly Birnbaum and her team at Cook Science to explain a cooking fundamental. And what, may you ask, could be more fundamental than cheese that melts and cheese that doesn't? Our managing producer, Sally Swift, checked in with Molly for our monthly lesson.
Molly, good to have you back.
Thanks so much.
I have heard rumors that you were stomping around rural Massachusetts looking for raw milk. What were you up to?
You heard correctly. My colleague Dan Souza and I were running around rural Massachusetts looking for raw milk because we wanted to illustrate the difference between goat milk and cow milk. We've been seeing goat milk all over the place. It's in normal supermarkets alongside the cow milk. But it is very different, and we wanted to really show how it is different. And we decided to go for raw milk, which we found at small farms, so that pasteurization wouldn't be an element in our crazy America's Test Kitchen tests that we then did.
So what did you discover?
So goat milk and cow milk are very different. Goat milk, first of all, gets its flavor from the presence of short and medium chain fatty acids. And these are fatty acids that give the milk its particular flavor. It's that kind of grassy, goaty, earthy flavor that you get mainly when you're eating goat cheese. It's very different from cow's milk. And we as humans are super sensitive to these fatty acids, that we can detect them in concentrations as low as 5 parts per million.
Wow.
Yeah.
And cow's milk?
It's very different, as a different flavor. And there are other things that really separate these two milks. And one of them has to do with fat, and that goat milk doesn't flocculate. And flocculate has become one of my new favorite words in all of English language. But what it means is that when you have a fresh container of cow's milk and you let it sit, the cream will rise to the top. That's flocculation. Goat's milk doesn't flocculate. The cream will not rise to the top.
So it just essentially stays mixed?
It stays mixed.
So exactly. how do these differences between these milks carry over to their cheeses?
Well, we decided to illustrate the difference by making fresh mozzarella with raw goat milk and raw cow's milk and seeing what happened. And what happened most importantly is that the cow's milk, one of the steps in mozzarella making is you stretch out the curds. So you kind of coagulate these milk proteins that are there. You create these curds and then you stretch them out. With the cow's milk, the stretching was magnificent. We could stretch the curds out to more than a foot long.
Wow.
With the goat milk mozzarella cheese, we could stretch it out a little bit, but then it kind of crumbled and fell apart. And this had a lot to do with the amount of casein, which is the most important milk protein present in each of these milks. And they have a different amount. Goat milk contains less casein than cow milk. And it's not a huge difference. It's a difference of 2.1% by weight to 2.6% by weight, but it is significant when it comes to the effects. And so when you have less casein, there's less protein to kind of coagulate and create a network that makes this cheese. So cow's milk is stronger. Goat's milk is softer. That's why goat's cheese is really kind of soft and full moisture because of less casein.
So how should we be handling goat cheese when we're cooking?
Well, goat cheese is not a great melter in that it barely melts at all. So we would not put it on pizza like we do with, you know, traditional mozzarella, which is a great melter. But goat's cheese doesn't melt, most importantly, because of how it's made and that it's an acid coagulated cheese. And when acid is added, it causes the casein proteins to bind super tightly and that they're very hard to break these bonds. So when you add heat to it, in other cheeses and younger cheeses with kind of more loosely bonded proteins, they quickly kind of flow apart and melt into this smooth, kind of beautiful, you know, pizza topping that you want. Goat cheese doesn't do that because these proteins are so tightly bound. It just kind of crumbles.
Mm-hmm.
So when we cook with goat cheese, we only lightly heat it. One of my favorite recipes that we do at America's Test Kitchen is an herbed baked goat cheese round in which you kind of coat a round of goat cheese in a crust with a little bit of egg and Melba toast. You freeze it so it gets super cold and then you bake it lightly so it gets warmed through and it has that kind of creamy, delicious feel, but it's not a melted cheese.
That's a great trick. So why freeze it?
It slows down the heating. It makes it so that the cheese won't kind of ooze out of its crust, and it allows the crust to crisp up while still keeping the cheese at the perfect texture and temperature.
Molly, that sounds delicious. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Molly Birnbaum is executive editor at Cook Science at America's Test Kitchen. She left us with that recipe for herb-baked goat cheese. Go check it out. SplendidTable.org. Australian-born Skye Gingell is one of Britain's most respected and acclaimed chefs. Once a food editor for Vogue magazine, she got her culinary training first in Sydney and then Paris before moving to London to become head chef at Petersham Nurseries Cafe, where she won a Michelin star in 2011. Skye has recently opened her first solo restaurant, Spring. She talked with our contributor, Noelle Carter, of the LA Times, about what she wanted in her own restaurant.
Skye, it's such a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Spring is your first solo restaurant. And, you know, restaurants still have this reputation for being male-dominated and not just in the kitchen. From its inception, Spring was largely designed and built by women with you at the helm. Was this a conscious decision on your part?
I think probably not conscious, although I have to be honest that I do find women amazing, and I'm sort of drawn to a kind of specific type of creativity, and it was extraordinary. You know, halfway through the project, we looked around and we thought, God, the project architect is a woman, the interior designer is a woman, we have this beautiful ceramic blossoms all over the wall. That's a woman. The uniforms were designed by a woman. My partner was a woman. And I don't know, just I think we were drawn to each other. That was what was really extraordinary. And I felt that it was so mutually supportive. Like I felt carried by them, especially Spring. Right. Was it's in a very, very beautiful building called Somerset House. But the actual site where we are is the old Inland Revenue offices. So it was quite a forbidding site in a way. Very beautiful, very unloved. And you kind of needed a lot of courage. It's got 24-foot high ceilings and huge windows, and it's right on the Thames. So it kind of felt like this sort of empty palace. And I just felt that all the women who seemed to pop up along the way, we all kind of trudged it together because it was a project that took almost 2 years, in fact.
Mm-hmm. There's something almost poetic about the way you connect with your ingredients. The recipes are very produce-driven and seasonal. What is your thought process when creating recipes?
Thank you very much. That's really lovely to hear. It's funny, I always start with one ingredient, and We do work very seasonally, and we also work with a biodynamic farm called Fern Vero. So they provide 95% of our produce. So the dishes in the restaurant are completely led by Fern Vero. I'm so fortunate to work with such beautiful ingredients, and I see them in a box and I literally cannot believe how beautiful they are. And so what I try and do is literally showcase the ingredients and try and not get in the way of the ingredients too much.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the simpler recipes? I loved the way you write about making basic butter.
Well, I think during the process of looking to start another restaurant, a restaurant really on my own this time, I felt very lost and very out of a kitchen. And so we found ourselves returning to things like breads and making butters and all the kind of almost forgotten skills, the really, really basic. I always say them to everyone in the kitchen, they're kind of biblical things, you know, making bread.
Right.
We were very inexperienced, in fact, in making bread, and we sort of started, and our first attempts were kind of poor. But over the kind of 18 months or so, we just found ourselves making bread every day. And then we branched into butters because that became kind of a natural sort of follow-on from bread. And I mean, it sounds funny, but the butter that we make and that is in the book is actually a kind of cultivated butter, but it's with kefir grains. But we started with so many different creams or mascarpones or creme fraiches, and just it was actually a really lovely time because in a restaurant, it's so busy every day that sometimes we don't have the luxury to really kind of get to the heart of things like bread and butters. And in the book as well, there's some sort of liqueurs and things that we started making with fig leaves. And it was a kind of experimental time for us, really. And those kind of fundamentals that are in the book, and the yogurts and the kind of ricottas and things, they were all things that we were doing to kind of keep ourselves sane as the restaurant was being built. And they sort of became part of the journey of opening Spring. So I really wanted to include them in the book.
Right. Another recipe that I tried recently was your slow-cooked zucchini with tarragon. And, you know, it's just a handful of ingredients, and the method is relatively simple, but the results are so incredible. And you mention at the top that it's one of the recipes that you keep coming back to, and it's one of the most popular recipes that you've served. Can you talk a little bit about the inspiration for that?
Do you know that recipe I have come back to over sort of 15, maybe even 20 years? I've cooked it every summer for such a long time. It's such an old friend of mine, and it's beautiful with chickens, it's beautiful with lamb, it's wonderful with fish. But it sort of came about really because, especially working completely seasonally and working with a vegetable garden, what you tend to have is a feast or a famine, and you get a glut of we call them courgettes. Do you call them zucchini?
Zucchini.
Yeah, your zucchini. And so it's almost like a jam you make, isn't it?
Right.
You cut them very, very finely, and you just tickle out the flavors through really long, patient cooking, in fact. It's just like keeping the temperature incredibly low. And then the tarragon, which is lovely with it, is not, I mean, sometimes I have it without the tarragon at all. It depends what it's with. And oftentimes I put so many other herbs in it, mint sometimes, or chervil, or sometimes I put dried chili in there. And it's funny because it's, of all the things I've ever cooked, strangely enough, it's one of the simplest, but it's also the one that everybody always says, oh, I love that zucchini recipe. That's my favorite, where you make the slow-cooked zucchinis. Yeah. And everyone in the restaurant loves it too, actually. I mean, all the staff, like, we always love making it.
Skye, this is such a beautiful book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Skye Gingell is chef owner of Spring Restaurant in London. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Skye shared with us a recipe for slow-cooked zucchini with tarragon. And you can find it at splendidtable.org. Rhubarb is a puzzling ingredient. Sour with oxalic acid, the Chinese have used its root for medicine for centuries. It's a sturdy plant with leaves that are poisonous to us and to those insects who may take a bite. Without sugar, it's more of a liver tonic or digestive. In fact, it was the addition of sugar that turned this vegetable into what we think of it today, a pie plant. Mark Hagen is executive editor of Taste of Home and sat down with our producer, Jennifer Russell, for a rhubarb primer.
Mark, welcome to the Splendid Table.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So rhubarb is in season. What should we know about it?
Well, there's two types of rhubarb. There's the hothouse rhubarb, which is rhubarb that's grown in a hothouse. And that's something that you might see across the country in larger grocery stores and things like that, which is perfectly fine and it tastes delightful. But then there's also the field-grown rhubarb, and that's the kind of rhubarb that farmers are growing. You'd buy that at a farmer's market. Perhaps you have a patch of rhubarb at your home, or maybe your neighbor has some that they like to share with you because it grows so abundantly. So the field-grown rhubarb tends to have a little bit more flavor. The stalks are a nice red color. The hothouse rhubarb isn't quite as flavorful, and the stalks vary as far as are they pink, are they red? They might be green and speckled with a little pink or red. People actually think it's the color that they're looking for, mm-hmm. and it's not. It doesn't really matter how deep that red is or how light that pink is. The flavor is going to be the same. What you want to look for are stalks that are nice and crisp. They're free of blemishes. Ideally, you want to look for stalks that aren't at their full maturity. So these are smaller, younger stalks. Now, a normal rhubarb stalk is about 1 to 2 inches in diameter. So if you're looking for those younger stalks, look for things that are smaller than 2 inches in diameter. And a real good key is if they have the leaves on them, look for smaller leaves. That's a good indication that you're getting a younger stalk, which is going to have just a little bit more flavor, but it's going to be a lot more tender when you're baking with it. You don't have to worry about those tough fibers that you might find in an older stalk of rhubarb.
Oh, that's a great tip. And we eat the stalks, but we don't eat the leaves, right?
You do not eat the leaves. The leaves have a certain amount of acidity to them that could be toxic. So you want to cut those off right away. Keep them away from pets. I think most pets stay away from them, but just get rid of them as soon as you can. And usually when you're in the grocery store, the leaves will be cut off. I think even a lot of farmers markets remove them for mm-hmm. you. If not, you want to remove those leaves.
You know, I think so many people can be intimidated when it comes to cooking with rhubarb.
I think one of the issues with rhubarb and people being nervous about it is because it has such a small growing period. April and May is really its peak. So I think that people are nervous about it because it's not out there year-round, so they don't have as much time to get in the kitchen and play with it. So really, if people just take the plunge and buy some rhubarb, they'll see how easy it is to work with. I think you should remember that rhubarb itself has sort of a texture and has some of the characteristics of celery. You know, it's in stalks, it's shaped the same, it's made of a series of fibers, there's a lot of water in rhubarb. So really, if you're not nervous about cooking with celery, you really shouldn't be nervous about baking with rhubarb.
That is such a great connection to make.
Thank you. I'm awesome at this.
And rhubarb is also one of those ingredients that really plays well with others.
It does. You'll see a lot of recipes that pair it with strawberries, but you're also seeing it with raspberries. Now, rhubarb usually has to be sweetened because it is quite tart. As I'm sure you and your listeners know, honey is very hot, hot, hot right now. So we're seeing a lot of recipes where rhubarb is sweetened, maybe not with sugar, but with honey. Also with maple syrup. So it does really pair very, very well with other fruits, other berries, and then natural sweeteners such as honey. And it's great in pies. You know, my favorite is a good old-fashioned slab pie. So it really does pair well in everything, quick breads. We're seeing a lot of chutneys right now. But, you know, you can also take rhubarb in a savory direction, and it surprisingly pairs nicely, I think, with chicken breast. But we're seeing a lot of people cook with lamb and rhubarb. And I also think it does well with pork, to be honest. I think if you want to experiment with rhubarb, I would recommend doing a quick rhubarb butter. Simply take one stalk of rhubarb, cut it into bite-sized pieces, and simmer that up on the stovetop with maybe a quarter cup, a third cup of orange juice, a little bit of honey. I would throw in personally a rosemary sprig. And just simmer that up until that rhubarb is nice and tender. And then all you have to do is drain it and let that rhubarb sit until it's cool. And then mix it in with a stick of butter that you softened. And then now you have this rhubarb butter that you can add to chicken breast, or it would be fantastic on pork chops. You can even put that on some grilled corn on the cob. It just is an easy, simple, fast way to experiment with the savory side of rhubarb.
All right, Mark, I'm heading out to get some rhubarb.
Do it.
Thank you so much for coming in today. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Hagen is executive editor of Taste of Home. He shared a trio of recipes: blueberry rhubarb breakfast sauce, raspberry rhubarb slab pie, and rue barbecue sauce. Find them all at splendidtable.org. Coming up, time to talk to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to turn to your calls, 800-537-5252. You can go to Facebook. You can go to Twitter. Now, Philip is calling from Washington, D.C. Hey, Philip, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, it's great to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
So over the last year, I've gone from someone who's just enjoyed eating food to someone who's actually enjoyed cooking food.
Huh.
And so my question is, barring salt, pepper, and olive oil, what are five ingredients that every kitchen should have for any type of cuisine?
This is sort of a version of Stump the Cook in a way.
A little bit.
Yeah. No, but, you know, it's a great question, though, because, you know, you start looking at recipes and you end up saying, wait a minute, do I have to have that and that and that?
Right.
And you spend a fortune and a lot of it sits there.
Yes.
Okay. This depends on what you like. All right. I would say for me, canned beans.
Okay.
Because they're really, you know, they're very respectable. If you don't make beans yourself. Tomatoes and tomato paste. Tomato paste is loaded with umami, you know, that chemical combination that sort of lifts all boats when you add it to something. It just lifts the flavors of everything it comes in contact with. And small amounts of tomato paste, I mean, literally like a half teaspoon in a salad dressing or a little bit in a pan sauce, it lifts, really, it just lifts the flavors. And it doesn't necessarily give it a strong tomato taste. Okay, so tomato paste, I love to have canned tomatoes. We're heading into a season when fresh will be available. But
right.
The other thing is, I think you want to have some pasta or noodles of some kind, because that can always, with whatever you want to add to it, make a very fast supper. And there's just so many great things you can do with noodles.
Right.
Well, anchovies. If you don't like anchovies, forget this. But anchovies are kind of like tomato paste.
Okay.
If you put them in a bit of lemon juice or vinegar, you know, and what I do is I empty the can into a jar and then I pour in enough vinegar to cover it. And that mellows out the anchovy. And the anchovy is going to just make everything else taste better. And you can take a huge bunch of parsley, a bit of lemon, and some garlic, and you let the lemon juice sit over the garlic while you're doing other things for about 20 minutes. And then you drop in a few anchovies with that vinegar, and you just puree the whole thing. And you've got a sauce that is so delicious. Use it instead of mayo. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely fabulous. And you can do that with any herb, but especially parsley. Are these things that you like?
I mean, what I'm discovering is just trying not to assume that I do or don't like them, and just finding things that I think are interesting or things that I have never even thought of trying before.
Okay.
And then just trying them. So all of these are great. I mean, I definitely have found that pasta is really great to have around, and tomatoes are. I haven't tried tomato paste yet, so that'll be really interesting. Anchovies I haven't really reached out to yet, just because I think growing up there was a stigma that
yeah.
they're...
And you
know,
may not
really...
like them. So if you don't like them, you know, just forget about them.
Yeah, just try it.
By the way, just an aside, when you have a really good baked potato, you mash in that anchovy into those potatoes with a little bit of whatever else you want to put in it, if you're splurging butter, but olive oil is wonderful.
Okay.
It is so good, I cannot tell you. But let's say for number five, oh, how could I forget? Vinegar.
Vinegar? Any particular type of vinegar or just regular vinegar?
I like cider vinegar. It's a good general vinegar, but I collect vinegars. You know, there's 100 kind of vinegars.
Sure.
That or, as your fifth ingredient, would be either fish sauce or soy sauce.
That's what I was wondering, because I see that so often in, in things that I'm looking up.
Yeah. All of these are adjuncts that are going to make other things taste a lot better.
Great.
Yeah. So that's a good place to begin. And then you add as you decide, I really love those flavors. And then you start adding those components.
That sounds great.
I love the approach and enjoy it. This sounds like a lot of fun.
Thank you, Philip.
You're welcome. Bye. Eleanor is calling from San Francisco. Eleanor, what would you like to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I am so excited to talk to you.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to talk to you.
So my question has to do with preserving citrus.
Yeah.
A friend of mine gave me some preserved lemons as a Christmas gift, and I finally just tucked into them, and I've been putting them on everything. I love them so much. And it got me thinking, could I preserve other types of citrus? And if so, what would be some good spice combinations to use for some other types of citrus?
Well, the basis for the preserved lemons is salt. Mm-hmm. And as you know, because the method is that you cut the lemon, not all the way through, but you cut it from top to bottom in wedges. And you kind of open it up like a flower. And then what you do is you put a layer of salt in the bottom of a jar, and then you put in the lemon and you pack salt into it, and then you put another layer, and then you put, you know, and so on up the top until everything is covered with salt, and then you leave it for 4 or 5 weeks. Oh, and then lemon juice goes into it. So it's acid and salt, which are two prime preservatives. Now, I have never done this, but I would imagine you could do this with oranges. You could do this with almost anything else, limes. But you have to make sure, for instance, with oranges, you wouldn't use orange juice. You would use lemon juice. Because you want that high acid content. And you'd get, I mean, I think it would be fascinating to see what would happen with an orange or with a tangerine or a tangelo. I would say any kind of citrus would be fabulous done with the salt and the acid, lemon juice. I think it's worth a try.
I will do just that, and I will report back.
Okay. Just give it a bit of time, you know, and keep it away from heat and light, and you're in business. And keep it covered with the acid. I think you're going to have a lot of fun with it.
Yes.
Hey, enjoy.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Hey, you're welcome. And you take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Joyce wrote to us through Twitter and wants to know how to eat a more plant-based diet, especially using lentils and beans. Well, Joyce, you're singing my song. I love beans and I love lentils. This is what you can do. First of all, take a whole bunch of raw vegetables that you like, chop them up, toss them with some oil and vinegar or any kind of salad dressing you like. Take a can of chickpeas or black beans or pinto beans, drain them, rinse them, and add them to that combination. And then stick it in the fridge. And that's what you're going to have for lunch on the weekend. That's what you're going to have for supper when you come home from work. Put it on a bed of salad greens. You could have that next to a baked potato. And of course, there are soups that you can do with beans and lentils. I'll give you an instance. With lentils, what you can do is first you cook them. And lentils are really easy to cook. You rinse them. And then you cover them with some kind of liquid, whatever liquid you would like, okay? And you let them simmer very gently, 15 to 20 minutes or until they're tender and soft. If you need more liquid, don't hesitate to add it. You'll lightly cover the pan. Now, you want them to be soft but still hold their shape, unless they're red lentils. And red lentils, you know, they're tiny, tiny, tiny pieces, and they're orangey red. And when they cook, they turn a very pleasant brown color, and they turn into a puree all on their own. Now, either way, you can spice these things with everything you could imagine. For instance, to do a Middle Eastern version, cumin, coriander, both fresh and the ground seed, a bit of cinnamon, a bit of allspice, a bit of clove, garlic, and if you like, sweet paprika or hot paprika. And then you can add, chopped up carrot
chopped up celery, bits of broccoli. You could add also greens to it. So you could add chard. You could add kale. You get where I'm going here? And you keep the, you know, you add liquid to make sure it's either can be a stew or if you add more liquid, you have a soup. But you see what I'm saying? Now, any of these things are going to keep for about 5 days in the fridge and they're going to freeze pretty well. And when it comes to beans, there's a selection of beans out there that never end. You can look at Christmas beans. They're beautiful to look at. Of course, there's pinto beans. There's Italian Borlotti beans. There's cannellini, which are creamy and have a sweet undertone. And of course, there's chickpeas, which are probably my all-time favorite. So experiment. Oh, and I forgot to mention, there's green lentils. They're French lentils, and they hold their shape really nicely, and they really take to things like a sauté of garlic and onion and chopped up vegetables and, you know, a little bit of thyme and rosemary. And then you just take the cooked lentils, you toss that all together with salt and pepper and let them sit in the fridge. And then again, you warm them gently and you can just eat them right out of the container. They're really delicious. So there are some ideas. And let us know how they're working for you. And thanks for the question. Call us at 800-537-5252. We have Kate calling from Nampa, Idaho. Kate, hi.
Hi, Lynn.
Where is Nampa?
It's right outside of Boise.
Ah, okay. I can picture it. Yes. It's such a gorgeous state. I was just wondering another place to think about visiting.
Yeah. So me and my kids live with my parents, and my sister and her husband and their kids live on at another house on the property, and my sister does most of the cooking, and we all love onions, but my dad can't handle the smell when onions are cooked on the stove.
Oh my, that's interesting.
Yeah. Oh. So we've tried to caramelize the onions in the oven, but they always come out, half of them charred.
Too high heat, I think.
Too high of heat?
Yeah, too high heat. Let me explain the caramelization process. I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, okay?
Okay. Oh, good.
Yeah. Ideally, what you want to do is you have some fat of some kind, and you have the onions sliced or diced or whatever, and you kind of cook them in that fat slow. And you do it in a wide open pan because you want to evaporate the moisture. And I always salt them lightly, because that helps draw out the moisture too. Because if they have a lot of moisture in them, and they're not going to caramelize if that moisture is present. So you cook them kind of slow. They get limp looking. They get clear, and they start to pick up color. And then you slowly let them caramelize, or you raise the heat ever so slightly, but you stir them because, you know, they can burn in a hot minute. And maybe when you're doing it in the oven, use the biggest, widest pan you have, so you just have a layer of onion. And by the way, you can do a big batch of this, and then it'll keep. You can freeze it, or you can put it in the fridge. It'll keep probably 5 or 6 days.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah, and then what you do is, with the oven, what I would do is cook them at about 250 to 300, and get them really soft. Don't hold back on olive oil or whatever. Be a little on the generous side and don't forget the salt. And then watch them. And watch them as they start to pick up color. They're going to get to be, a pale blonde. And when they look like a caramel, they're there.
Okay.
And you're going to have to pull them out and stir them every so often. But but once you've done them, you know, if you do a big batch of it, it's done. And then you can just put it, you know, you can use it anywhere you want to use it.
Should I cover the onions in the oven at all?
No. No.
Okay.
Well, if you want to soften them up, and if you see them browning too quickly, they have to get to the point where they're clear and they're limp. And then they go to caramel.
Right.
Okay. So if that's moving too fast, just knock the heat down.
Okay.
Okay?
Because
if you cover them, you know, you're trapping in the moisture.
Oh, and that would never caramelize.
Right. Well, you know, very slowly. I mean, really slowly. So
really
give it a try. And if you run into a problem, give us a call.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn.
Hey, thank you, Kate. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us today. And you have a great week. Let me leave you with this thought from Dennis Miller, who said, Washington, D.C. is to lying what Wisconsin is to cheese. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found at our website, splendidtable.org, so be sure to check it out. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Hey, thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.